because trees bring us a lot to our landscape. Beauty, shade, home for wildlife, and so you don't want to lose one. Our next guest has all the latest info on what may be threatening the trees in your area. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau, and back with us is Paul Segan. He is the DNR Forest Health Specialist out of Hayward, and he has updates on oak wilt, emerald ash borer, spruce budworm, and tent caterpillars, and probably some more. And of course, we can take your calls. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. So, Paul, welcome back.
Thanks, Jill. I'm super excited to be here in this new era of you taking on the torch from Larry. It's it's sad to see him go, but I'm really excited about this edition with you now.
Well, thank you so much. I think we all kind of feel that way, too. Larry's doing great. Just talked to him a little bit ago. So, yeah.
Great. Yeah. Hopefully he's listening in and getting all his questions answered.
Yeah. Well, he said he was planning to call in one of these days, so I'm sure he will. You got all that free advice all those years, you know, you're going to continue doing it. So how's the air quality up by you doing?
Well, I woke up this morning and things really cleared off. It looks like a southerly wind sort of pushed a lot of that haze out of the Hayward area. And so if I hadn't known anything, I'd say we're back to normal air conditions. We do have just a little bit of a downgrade in the air quality index, but things are looking quite good. And I'm optimistic that as we go into the weekend, we won't get that sort of second round of smoke that we've been maybe hearing about. But I know this afternoon, I'm going to get out and try to enjoy some time outside finally after this being hemmed in a bit over the last 2 days.
Yeah, it's still kind of bad down here. So hopefully it's going to blow out here too. Of course, you know, it could be a lot worse. We could have the fires. So
that's true. We have to be grateful for that too.
Yes, absolutely. So we have a lot to talk about in a short time. So let's get right into it. First thing on your list was oak wilt. What's going on with that?
Yeah, well, I was out of the office for a couple of days for meetings. And when I got back to my inbox, I saw about 10 emails from folks around my territory, which is the northwest part of the state, reporting symptoms of oak wilt. So it seems like there's a real concentration this week of the expression of symptoms. So oak wilt is really showing up in northern Wisconsin, and some of my colleagues have said in other parts of southern Wisconsin too. Not surprising. It's about the time of year we would expect to see oak wilt symptoms, but interesting how the switch got flipped. So what we're going to be thinking about with oak wilt is now is really the time to be watching your healthy oaks in your yard or in your forest. And things we want to look for is any rapid changes in the color of those leaves, particularly on the outside, furthest ends of the branches and up toward the tip of the crowns of the tree. And what's usually associated with that change in leaf color, which is usually kind of a light colored green to a bronze or brown color, is the rapid loss of leaves from that crown. And so leaves start to drop pretty precipitously around this mid-July through about September timeframe. And that's a real telltale sign that the tree is likely infected with oak wilt. There aren't many other diseases that cause such a rapid leaf loss in the trees. And so if that's what folks are seeing, it's really important to try to get some identification and diagnosis on that tree or those groups of trees if in a forest as soon as possible. And there's a number of resources to do that. DNR has a great fact sheet and video and sets of picture resources online, as does the UW Extension, that show what oak wilt would look like, as well as experts who are, you know, on the other end of a line to help you if you do think you may have oak wilt. In the case of a forest setting, the DNR Forest Health staff, of which there are about six in the state here, are represent different zones of the state where you can look up our contact and reach out to us, send us photos, maybe schedule a site visit if we're talking about more of a forest setting. But also the UW Extension has a really good setup to help landowners identify what the cause might be. One of the avenues for that is the online form, Ask Your Gardening Question from UW Extension. And there you can write a description of what you're seeing on your tree and also upload some photos. And an extension agent or a delegated master gardener in that area will look at those images and respond back to you with what they think might be the cause. Of course, we've got the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic for those shade tree inquiries across the state down in UW-Madison's lab, and they're very good at receiving and analyzing samples for oak wilt to determine what the cause. But proper diagnosis is really key, but I really emphasize the sooner folks can get the identification, the more options are left on the table to try to prevent other trees from dying. It's worth noting, once a tree gets infected with oak wilt, it almost always will die from it. And so usually we can't save those trees that are infected, but the question is, can we save other ones nearby? And often the answer is, if we move rapidly, we certainly can.
Okay.
So let's keep our eye out for oak wilt as we move into the rest of the summer here.
All right. We do have a call from Susan in La Crosse, so let's go to that right away. Go ahead, Susan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We have several what I think are mature spruce trees that are affected by needle cast. Is there any hope?
Yes, Susan, there is some hope for needle cast. It's a pretty common fungal disease that we tend to see cause more issues during wet, kind of cool spring type weather. We've had a little bit of that around the state. It's somewhat variable, but yeah, what we tend to see with needle cast is the inside portion of the tree tends to lose needles, and usually from the bottom up. And that's where the most humid types of microclimate on that tree are. And so a couple of things you can do are you can rake up those needles that fall each year and try to get them away from that tree. Why is that? Well, those needles collect spores that end up infecting other parts of the tree. So that's really good to kind of keep the area clean when we're talking about rhizosphere needle cast and other types of diseases on conifers. The other thing we like to see is not really watering the tree from above. By that, I mean sprinkler systems can tend to be a high risk factor for these spruce because it creates that moist environment. So anytime we're watering our trees and spruce trees, definitely water them from below using a drip hose or a soaker hose around the tree. Next is circulation, keeping the area so that it gets some wind draft coming through. We want to kind of dry out those needles and not permit prolonged water on the needles. As far as direct controls, there are some fungicides that can be used for rhizosphere needle cast, and they can still be deployed at this time of the year. It's a little bit late. You could probably get one round of treatment in, but better is to probably wait until next season. What we tend to see is that the copper-containing fungicides work well for rhizosphere, and with that, we're looking at about two applications per season. One about mid-May when, depending on where you are in the state, when that growth shoot is about halfway elongated or several inches grown out. And then a final application with this, it's a type of foliar spray, onto the fully grown sprigs of the tree once they're about 6 inches or so grown out. So two applications generally provide prevention of new infections on the tree. Of course, thinking about, is your tree worth treating relative to, does it have a lot of leaf loss already? Is it pretty malformed? So you want to decide, is it worth investing in terms of its shape? Because those needles that died earlier, they're not really going to come back in that same growth area. So you definitely want to decide, is it worth the time and effort? But if the tree's in good shape otherwise, I think treatment's a really good idea.
Okay, good luck, Susan. Thanks for that call. Bert in Mosinee has some follow-up questions. Go ahead, Bert.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I've had oak wilt for about a year and a half now, and I took out two of the big trees in my yard that had oak wilt this last winter. And now I have a few trees off into the woods that are just died this last week. And I have two more oaks in the yard that I really want to save. My question is, do I take these three that just died out now, or is it better to leave them until winter?
Yeah, that's a good question. We generally recommend keeping that tree uncut and on its stump, so to speak, until it's fully wilted. The reason seems counterintuitive. Why wouldn't we want to get rid of the tree right away? Well, the reason is it turns out that cutting that tree while it's actively wilting can relieve the tension that tree is pulling on the sap stream. What that can do is cause other trees nearby to start to suck in the fungus into their own root system. So we want to prevent that and let those trees sort of wilt in place. And then next, we want to maybe remove them toward the end of the season. And at the very minimum, make sure they don't leave the site. We want to keep them on the site so that the oak wilt disease doesn't end up in new areas. Best case scenario would be to cut those trees up into, say, 8-foot logs or bucket up into shorter chunks of wood and tarp it down to the ground level and bury the tarp edges to prevent new infections in that area. Oak wilt spreads when small beetles will visit the spore mats that form on a oak wilt killed tree following spring and transmit it to new areas. So covering that wood can be very important. Now, with regard to protecting your trees that are still alive, you said you had several in the yard you'd like to try to save. There's some really good options in that regard, and they come down to using a fungicide injection. Certified arborists have access to a product called Alamo, or propiconazole is the chemical name, and it's really effective at oak wilt control if the tree isn't showing symptoms of oak wilt yet. And so what I would encourage you to do is get on the line with a certified arborist who has pesticide certification and see if you could get some estimates on treating those trees with the propiconazole injection. We see that every other year it's required for injection for about 3 cycles, and that seems to allow trees to survive in perpetuity if they get that 3 cycles every other year of the treatment. Mm-hmm. So that's a good route to go for those trees in the yard you want to save.
Okay, thank you very much for those follow-up questions, Bert. Mike in Northern Illinois emailed us. He has a mature Crimson King that is dying via girdling. It is growing about 12 feet from a concrete foundation and 6 feet from a paved alley. 2 arborists have told him it can't be saved. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a pretty common problem we see in a lot of these yard trees, especially maple, where we get what's called stem girdling roots. Oftentimes these trees were planted sometimes 20, 30 years ago from a container. And as these trees grew at the nursery in a container, their roots kind of hit the sidewall of the plastic container and then started turning right or left and then grew in a circle. As that tree expands years and years later, when it's in the ground, those roots also grow just like the stem does. And at some point they meet and they are both expanding and they both want to kind of win that growth game. What that does is it cuts the growth off on the stem and physically causes it to weaken. And so typically girdling roots that are well advanced on a tree, that sounds like this one's a little bit bigger, is not a lot you can do about it. And I would consider starting to think about a replacement strategy. Now, a tree with stem girdling roots can live for many years, and we tend not to see these problems manifest until 20 to 30 years later. So it's possible you could get some more years out of this tree, but I would start making a plan if there's a suitable location near the tree to plant an alternative. Maybe you want another Crimson King maple. You could plant it nearby outside of the drop zone when this tree eventually has to come down. But in the long run, you're going to want to start to think about alternatives because it's not a condition that is easily remedied.
Okay, thanks for that. Let's get back to some of our listed things that we want to talk about. Emerald ash borer, of course. Mm-hmm. Can't get away from that. What's up with that?
Well, it's an annual issue, and we have it all around the state. Of course, all 72 counties in Wisconsin have a positive detection, and we are starting to check the box on new municipalities and townships with the presence of EAB. And so anywhere in the state at this point, it's recommended to consider using insecticides to protect any healthy ash that you want to protect. If we're talking about the forest setting, we really would encourage folks to start working with a certified forester, get some eyes on their property, do an assessment to determine if there's some value that can be captured in that forest yet, and if there's some good harvesting or silvicultural management practices that can be implemented that might promote non-ash regeneration to promote productivity, wildlife habitat, other ecological values, which are really important from our Wisconsin forests here. When it comes to treating ash trees that are in a yard, there's a lot of options right now. But the first question is the tree worth treating? Now, it really depends on how much of that crown has been affected. And when we're at the point of more than 50% crown decline or leaf loss in those upper branches of the tree, we tend to see it's probably not worth treating at that point. Other things we can consider is the location of the tree in the yard. Is it in a location that provides a lot of shade? Is it provide a lot of aesthetics? Does it provide some screening from a street? Other values that we would hold high for our trees in our yard. So if it meets that criteria and it's worth a lot to you in terms of the shade, in terms of its location and aesthetic, and it doesn't have 50% crown decline, then it's a good idea to consider treating it. And there's a whole lot of options to do that. At this time of the year, you know, we're coming on a little past mid-July. The only options really left are going to be kind of an arborist grade injection. And those would involve such products as the chemical name would be emamectin benzoate. Those are really effective at protecting ash trees, sometimes more than 2 years of protection from one injection. These are especially important if that tree is over 15 inches in diameter, because some of the homeowner grade products just aren't effective enough on these larger trees. So if we're talking about something under 15 inches in diameter, you could consider going with a higher grade arborist type product and hiring a certified arborist now to do a treatment. You get a very good product and you get probably 2 to 3 years of protection. But you could also wait it out until next year and use kind of a less expensive homeowner remedy, which is usually a soil trench. It's a compound that's mixed with water and poured around the base of the tree and provides usually just 1 year of protection. But economically, they're a little bit more economical. But yes, if you really want to get to it this year, you could still call a certified arborist and look at getting that tree treated. And the compounds are really effective these days. Some of the products are really good, and I've worked with a lot of landowners who have used it, and it's really nice to see you come back to an ash after 5 years that's been treated, and it's still growing strong, and it provides that shade and provides all those values. So you really have to decide, is it worth it to you? And in a lot of cases, it might be if you want to do the investment.
Yeah, for sure. George in Westport, go right ahead. It's your turn.
Thank you for taking my call. And first of all, congratulations, Jill.
Oh, thank you.
I have a question regarding a Kentucky coffee tree that I started from a bean that I picked up in Albert Lea, Minnesota about 20 years ago. And it grew very robustly. It's probably about 20 feet tall now with a bottom diameter of the trunk at about 6 inches. But about 3 weeks ago, the foliage started turning yellow from the base of the canopy on up until it's close to the top foot of it. And it looks to me like it's not going to survive. And I'm curious what could have happened to it. There's no bark damage, as I can see, at least. What do you know about those trees?
Yeah, George, was there any potentially herbicide application around that tree that could have affected the foliage?
There is one possibility of it. I live next to Governor Nelson State Park, and they recently created a fire, what is it called, a fire stop or something or other around the couple of properties that are literally in the park. And so they removed everything, and then they sprayed something out there. This tree is probably 10 to 12 feet from that particular area.
Okay. So there might have been some root damage that occurred?
If yes, now that I think about it, yes, that would be a possibility, I think.
Okay, yeah, that could be. That would reduce the amount of water uptake in the tree. It sounds like this might be a little bit of a wilting symptom, though the symptoms from the bottom up is maybe not what I'd expect so much with wilting. The other possibility I would look at is verticillium wilt. I know this can affect Kentucky coffee tree. It's moderately susceptible. So that could be a cause too. Though with that, we generally expect it to occur in one section of the crown more so than any other. So if this is throughout the whole crown, somewhat evenly moving up, I might not think that's what it is, but yeah, it's still a possibility. Things that I think about: possible herbicide damage, possible root impacts from this fire break, and then maybe verticillium wilt. I would really suggest collecting a sample and getting it diagnosed by the plant disease diagnostic clinic. They can give you a better read on it. You can do both photos where you send in and also physical samples. So that would probably be what I would do, because it sounds like this tree is really important and it sounds like it's been growing for a while. You won't want to lose it.
Okay, thank you very much for that call. And good luck, George. How sad would that be to lose that tree?
We always talk about Kentucky coffee trees, a great replacement to ash. So we don't want to lose them after all that effort to restore some canopy in the area.
They've got a similar leaf, don't they?
Yeah, this big long compound leaf.
Yeah.
And it was so interesting that George had collected that seed pod and planted it from over in Minnesota. So it makes it extra special to try to save that tree. But yeah, beautiful one indeed.
Okay. We've got another call from Lee, and he's in Green Bay. Go ahead, Lee.
I just wanted to know a little bit about what's happening in the state with our Dutch elm disease. I have 4 accolade elms that I've had in for at least close to 25 years, maybe. Will my accolades have a lot better chance of not becoming contaminated with all the other Dutch elm, you know, the elms, or American elms, I should say, dying off?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's something I'm seeing all over right now. Just about a week ago, the Dutch elm disease symptoms in the wild elms along fence rows and along ditches of highways really started to take off in terms of Dutch elm disease wilt. And the appearance of this looks a lot like oak wilt, but it's an elm tree. We start to see the upper portions of the leaves start to brown out, or in the case of Dutch elm disease, usually a yellowing, a really stark yellowing coloration, and then rapid leaf loss there. And a lot of these wild elm are highly susceptible to Dutch elm disease, one of the most impactful diseases we've ever seen in North America that wiped out back in the 70s, boulevards in cities in Ohio and Wisconsin and Illinois of elm. And so what's been done and what you're describing is a type of elm that this accolade that's actually slightly resistant to Dutch elm disease. There were certain breeding programs that found resistant varieties of elm and bred them together, and accolade was one that resulted from that effort. And so it comes with pretty good resistance to Dutch elm disease. And so what we do find is that these resistant varieties are not 100% immune to Dutch elm disease, but they're often less susceptible to initial infection, and a lot of times they're more tolerant of Dutch elm disease. So if they end up getting infected, there's certain mechanisms that the tree has internally and how it grows and some of its chemistry that help fend off Dutch elm disease. So accolade, I can't say specifically because there is a rating. Some of these have more or less resistance, but I think you can find some of that online. And I think you're in good shape. I think it's really good you've got those resistant varieties. And I would encourage you to keep those trees healthy with some other means too, just your common cultural methods, mulching, watering during dry weather, things of that sort. But yeah, good on you to get a resistant elm variety growing there.
Okay, thank you, Lee. Paul, we've got like a minute. We haven't talked about spruce budworm or forest end caterpillars yet.
Yeah.
Can you tell us real quick?
Yeah, so we've got these native defoliators across the state right now, and we're seeing blow-ups in different areas of the state. Northern Wisconsin, the northern third, is really, we're seeing a slow rolling fire of the spruce budworm. It's an insect that's been active now for the 14th consecutive year, and it's been in outbreak mode, and we tend to see it go after balsam fir and spruce, and slowly within several years of heavy defoliation, we start to see the balsam and spruce wink out. They usually have some top kill, and eventually the whole crown turns brown. And so we are seeing a lot of this effect in those northern counties. We are still seeing spruce grow back, but it's going to be a change somewhat in the composition of the forest, at least in the short term, until we can get more spruce and fir growing. And it's a natural thing. We've seen this, you know, it's been documented in history, but we are keeping an eye on it and we are mapping it. The other thing we've got going on right now is the native forest tent caterpillar. Some of those north central counties, like around Medford into the north, are really experiencing some moderate to heavy defoliation in patches of the aspen. That's the most affected species by the forest tent caterpillar. And that's also a cyclic outbreak that we tend to see after between 6 and 10 years of periods of quiet. We're expecting that insect is really going to blow up here in the next few years based on these early warning signals of patchy defoliation. Last one is the jack pine budworm, another native insect that we're starting to get reports up in the Bayfield Peninsula, where there's all that jack pine growing, of some real isolated, heavy outbreaks there. But hoping that they're pretty constrained, and we don't expect wide-scale mortality from that event.
Okay. Wow. Good job. Now you can take a breath. Thank you for all those updates. We really appreciate you spending some of your day with us and letting us know what's going on, Paul. Hopefully those skies are clearing up. So thanks.
Thanks, Jill. We'll talk to you next time.
Okay. Sounds good. Paul Segan is the DNR Forest Health Specialist out of Hayward.